Yesterday I spoke to you about a rather realistic view of you and your mate. And today I want to talk realistically about you and your ministry. And I just may as well get it off my chest. That is the strangest coat I think I've ever seen in my life, right here. I just couldn't continue until I got that cleared out. Wonderful man inside that coat, but a very unusual coat. Now, in all honesty, as yesterday, I have no interest in discouraging anyone, either about marriage or about ministry. But I am committed to speaking the truth in love. I feel that it's helpful for all of us to enter not only the new summer that's before us, but the new ministry that will be many of yours to experience, to go into it with our expectations in check. I've learned in my 35 years in ministry that if I keep my expectations in check, I will have far fewer disappointments and discouragements. And in all honesty, I don't know of a generation that I have ever been a witness to or of that I have sensed a greater emphasis on success and rapid growth and instant gratification. And you may have been bitten with this bug over the last few years. You may have been reared in a context by your own parents where your succeeding is among the most important things about you. If that's true, I regret that for you. Because ministry is not about success. Great ministries are not about size or growth or being gratified. Ministry is about glory to God and the importance of pleasing Him and being reminded again and again, He is the potter and we are the clay. In today's terms, He calls the shots. We respond to His directions. Now, make no mistake about it, Job said it right in 23:10. He knows the way I take. Literally, He knows the way with me. When He has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. That not only makes great preaching, that is what living in ministry is all about. Remembering, He knows the way, implying, I don't. And remembering that trials precede the making of gold. It isn't the other way around. And gold having nothing to do with monetary things. Gold having to do with greatness of character and significance of life. Impacting and being used of God to shape the lives of a few people. That is gold. That's what you've been training for. And if we fail to remind you of that sufficiently, let my last chapel talk remind you of that. Turn to Exodus chapter 2, please, as we begin. Moses is what we would call today middle age. He's 40. His formal schooling is behind him. and it was a rugged course. One old writer puts it well. What a magnificent land must Egypt have been in those days of which Herodotus and the hieroglyphic records speak. The atmosphere was rainless. The Nile brought from afar the rich alluvial soil that bore corn enough to feed the world. The banks of the river were covered with cities, villages, stately temples, and all the evidences of an advanced civilization. Whilst mighty pyramids and colossal figures towered to 100 feet in height and more, 7 millions of people throve on this green territory. And whilst the great mass of them were probably poor and ignorant, the upper classes, especially the priests, were remarkable for their familiarity with much of which we boast ourselves today. The cream of all this poured into the cup of Moses. He was brought up in the palace, treated as the grandson of Pharaoh. If he rode forth into the streets, it would be in a princely equipage amid the cries, "Bow the knee! Bow the knee!" If he floated on the Nile, it would be in a golden barge amid the strains of voluptuous music. If he wished for aught, the almost illimitable wealth of the treasures of Egypt was within his reach. That's Moses at age 40. He has it made. Highly qualified, if we can trust the writings of Josephus, not only was he now heroic in the battle against the Ethiopians as he led the Egyptian army, but he is the Pharaoh elect, groomed to occupy the highest throne in the land, in the world. And he blows it. He blows it royally. I think his intentions were right, but his actions were rash. In fact, downright stupid. Chapter 2 of Exodus, verse 11, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. He went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. One of his brethren, he looked this way and that, and when he saw there was no one around, he struck the Egyptian and then hid him in the sand. He's a murderer. And we look at that and we think, how could a man this highly educated, this greatly gifted, Stephen's word, a man mighty in words and deeds, how could a man like that do something that dumb? You do dumb things when you are in positions of authority. You take matters into your own hands if you're not careful. You act rashly. This is clearly a carnal act. And it was wrong. That's why he hid the evidence. In fact, his intentions were so right that he thought his brothers would understand. The day following, when he is back among them, one of them asks, "Are you going to kill me like you killed him?" I mean, the word was out. In verse 14, for the first time in his life, we read the word afraid connected to the man. He is afraid. It's perhaps one of the greatest moments in Moses' life. God knew the way that he took. God had plans for Moses that would take 40 years more to unfold. And he is afraid. "Surely," he says, "the matter has become known." And indeed it had. It got to the throne. The next verse reads in Exodus 2:15, "When Pharaoh heard of the matter, he tried to kill Moses." What an incredible change of situation. He's no longer the fair-haired son. He's now a fugitive. He's no longer full of hopes and dreams. He's afraid. He's full of fear. He's no longer the respectable leader of the troops. He's a failure. And he retreats, and he runs for his life. The words spoken by Stephen in Acts 7 and recorded by Luke say it all. Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian. We read in this latter part of verse 15 that he settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. Now, it's our tendency to hurry on to that and rush to the bush. But I want you to sit with Moses by the well for a few moments. Because if you don't do that today, you will find yourself nevertheless doing that someday. All of us have had our wells in the Midian desert. Change the time, the circumstances, change the location, change the details. Someday you will be there. You may be there now. It may happen soon in your ministry. It may not happen until you're 40 or 50. But God knows the way that you take. And when he has tried you, you will come forth as gold. I'm convinced that sitting down by a well is a part of God's schooling. It is here that the harsh curriculum of the Midbar sets in. The wilderness teaching. Such things as isolation, obscurity, loneliness, solitude, long dry spells, feelings of silence from God, a sense of distance, sometimes complete disillusionment. It's all part of sitting down by the well. I ask you, what good is all of that education now from his graduation at the Temple of the Sun in Egypt? And all those medals he earned while in battle against the alien forces against Egypt, they mean nothing. They get rusty in an old box. And he probably lost them all by the time he turned 80. Like Moses, you will find yourself by the well willing to do things that today you can hardly imagine. Here is this highly qualified man, verse 21, willing to dwell with an owner of sheep and to keep his sheep in the wilderness. It's hard to believe, isn't it? It's here he finds his wife. They have children. He even names one Gershom, verse 22, from the word, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." I know it's almost impossible to imagine yourself by a Midian well. I mean, you have great hopes. You have great dreams. And again, I'm all for great dreams and high hopes. I believe in setting our aims as high as they can possibly be. Our problem is not setting them high enough, it's allowing them to go too low. And I say, as you graduate in 17 days now, you graduate, I hope, with great dreams. Strong desires to serve him in a wonderful way. All I ask is that you step into those dreams realistically, because the well will come. A loss of a child incredible disruption of a ministry that was moving ahead, and out of the blue, an invasion of the enemy, or the breakdown of a friendship, or the deceitfulness of a body of elders, or some heartbreaking illness that levels you and, if you will, disqualifies you in carrying out your responsibilities. And your days will linger and you will wonder, what in the world is happening to me? It's easy for us, again, to look quickly over the words, the course of those many days. It's 40 years. It is over 4,300 months. It is more than 14,500 days. It's more time than some of you, most of you, have even lived. Let it sink in. 40 years. During that period of time, he finds his habitat no longer the courts of Egypt. His comforts are gone. Life is harsh. The job is monotonous. The dreams are gone. The comforts are few. The applause is over. I have been there. And I know some of you have too. Some who occupy this platform have been in deeper places by the well than I will ever know. Some of you have lost what I have never lost. But we will all be by the well at some time in our ministry. Verse 1 of chapter 3, he is pasturing the flock that belongs to Jethro, his father-in-law. He's been in this place for years and years. His sandals have slid over how many miles of hot gravel and sand and rocks, limestone. How kind of God to notice him. I don't have truth. I don't have proof of this, but down deep inside my heart, as I have identified and thought and meditated on the life of this man, I cannot help but think that he probably thought he had heard the last from God. He's a murderer. He's a fugitive. He left with a bad record. He acted in haste. He could hide the body, but he couldn't hide the facts. But he had failed. God, it was once great. Before I move into the scene that we're all familiar with, I want to take you to a section that we're not. Deuteronomy 32, please. This is from Moses' own journal, if you will. He writes of Israel, but I cannot help but think he's replaying scenes from his own life. Chapter 32 of Deuteronomy, verse 10. The first he, I believe, is God. I want to suggest, at least by application, that the him is Moses. God found Moses in a desert land, in the howling waste of the Midbar. Let those words linger in your mind. The Midbar, terrible place to be. I am certain that he felt alone and frightened on many occasions, but the scriptures read, God encircled him. Don't move too quickly through this. I'm sure he felt often in harm's way. I am sure he felt punished, rejected, ashamed, but we read God cared for him. I am sure that he was vulnerable and unprotected out there in the Midbar, but God guarded him as the pupil of his own eye. And I'm sure he felt confused, wondering where all this would lead and when he would just pass off the earth. Seen in verse 12 brings the encouragement. The Lord alone guided him. Alone. The term for solitariness is used. Badav. The Lord Yahweh alone guided him. That's the good part of the wilderness experience. That's the best part of education by the well. You listen less and less to others, and you begin to connect more and more with the living God. And somehow, though Moses didn't know the way he took, God knew the way he took. And it was all beginning to take shape. The Midbar crushes us, it purifies us, it remakes us, it strips us, it refines us. We just sang it in the old 200-year-old Portuguese hymn. When through fiery trials thy pathway shall lie, my grace all-sufficient shall be thy supply. The flame shall not hurt thee. I only design thy dross to consume, thy gold to refine. That's what it's about. It isn't about punishment. It isn't about some deity peeved against us, brutally whipping us. It's a caring, loving God who loves enough to discipline us so we won't be as rash, so we won't act in such carnality as we did when we were so capable. And you'll feel so alone. Coleridge words come back. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on a wide, wide sea. And not a man took pity on my soul in agony. He wrote of the mariner, all alone. I have felt so alone in places of ministry that I, in that epical frame of mind, couldn't name a friend. Though I'm sure there were some. Turn from Deuteronomy 32 back to Deuteronomy 8 on our way back to the bush. Deuteronomy 8. How insightful is that second verse? It's one of the verses that I memorized during my days in seminary and had no idea how the verse would comfort me in the years ahead. You shall remember, that's Moses' favorite word in Deuteronomy. You shall remember. This is Deuteronomos. This is the repeating of the law. This is a returning to the law. This is bringing it back to our attention just before we move into this promised land. You shall remember all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the Midbar. Could Moses speak with any sense of authority as he talked to the Israelites about 40 years? I've had my Midbar. I know what it's about. And why? He gives us three reasons. Look at them. The Midbar is to humble you. It is to test you. It is to help you know what's in your heart, whether you'd really keep his word or not. Mark those three objects of time by the well. To humble us, to prove us, to prove what's really there, and to help us see what's really in our hearts. And lest it sound like a penalty, look at verse 16. In the wilderness he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you. Look at this. To do good for you in the end. The NIV says, so that in the end it might be well with you. Is that grace or what? So that in the end you might just die and fade away? No. In the end, your gold might emerge. That's when you'll sense the significance of God's tests along the way. You'll see it later. Not now. And not when you're there. Now back to the bush. Exodus chapter 3. Love this scene. Here's Moses. Out in the open. Leading the sheep. The text reads in the New American Standard, to the west side of the wilderness. If I read the Hebrew correctly, it's to the farthest end of the wilderness. It's a long ways from nowhere. I mean, this is out back. I like the old King James, the back side of the desert. So he's back there where he's been before. He's leading the sheep. He's working with the sheep. He's doing what he's responsible to do. And he's now 80 years old. And he turns and he's seen bushes burn before. If you're in the desert enough, you've seen bushes burn. That combustion occurs, poof, and they burn and then they burn out. But this one wouldn't burn out. And he was curious. Now, he's never read Exodus 3, so he doesn't know what's coming. He sees a bush burning. He looks at the bush. He may be 80, but he's got his mind, and he's thinking, why doesn't it go out? He's a simple man now. And he walks over, and he hears something. He hears his name. Moses, Moses. Midbar is from davar, which is to speak. And how gracious of God in this place to speak to his friend, whom he has now brought all through the wilderness for these 40 years. Now, if you will allow me a little preacher's imagination, had it been 40 years earlier, I have a feeling he might have responded, oh, lucky you, you found me. Been wondering where you were, but it wasn't that at all. You know what he does? If you check the Hebrew and if you read his response, this reads as he responds to God, here am I. Verse 4 concludes, here I am. The Hebrew is just hineni. You don't have to move your lips when you do it. It's just like a little kid. Hineni. He wasn't expecting to hear from God. Some of God's very best messages come unexpectedly. And the rest is history. And he, for the next 40 years, is occupied in all the things that ministry is about. And tragically, it is our tendency to focus on the first 40 and the last 40 and to miss the mid-40s. When you are prepared to do a great work. I mean, there was greatness to be done. He was to confront a Pharaoh, and he would. He was to accomplish an exodus under the direct power of God, and he did. He was to shepherd millions of people, and he does. There was a Torah to write, and he did it. There was a model of meekness and humility When he dies at age 120, there is no one like him on the earth, the text says, in meekness and humility. And it would never have been true if it hadn't been for the Midbar in his life. God knew the way that he took. And when he tried him, he came forth as gold. Alexander White, one of my favorites, writes, "Some of you will know what 40 years in the wilderness and at the back of the Mount of God have done for yourselves. You know how those years have reduced and subdued your too high temper and weaned you off from the shams and the sweetnesses of this world and given you some eyes and some heart to suffer the loss of all things. And if 40 years have wrought such a change in a slow-hearted scholar of God as you are, you will not wonder at the man Moses as he came back from the land of Midian. Any use you are or ever likely to be, or have now any hope or any ambition to be, it all has its roots in the great grace of God." As I examine this part of Moses' life, I want to leave with you three perils that are the most common in ministry that Moses illustrates at this segment of his life. And each of the perils reveals a very common weakness in all of us. The first weakness is intensity, and the peril is running before we are called. Running before we are sent, I should say. Intensity is characterized by running before we are sent. I've done it. By the grace of God, I won't do it again, but I may. Intensity reveals itself in running before we are sent. And then the next weakness is insecurity, retreating after we have failed. If my imagination is accurate, I have a feeling that there was no more surprised man on the face of the earth than Moses when he heard that voice. His retreat had been so eloquent, had been so severe, he probably never anticipated again to hear his voice. You can do that when you fail. You can overreact. I just say to you again, as I have mentioned on a number of occasions from this pulpit in our chapel, just leave room for you to fail. It's part of your education. You don't get credit for it at Dallas Seminary. But there's a lot of credit that comes your way afterwards in the lessons learned. I have learned far more in my many failures than I have learned in my few successes. If I could take away anything from my past, it would not be my failures. That's where I've learned the most. The third is the weakness of inferiority, resisting when we are called. And that's what the bush is all about. Well, that's my message for you on the ministry. And I find myself tempted to follow suit with my current generation, and that's somehow to protect you from that, to give you a few tips on how to skirt the well. But I'm going to restrain that temptation. You will simply not accomplish the things you long to accomplish until some years have passed. I'll just put it that way. Just take some years. Sarah Teasdale, the poetess, put it like this: when I have ceased to break my wings against the faultiness of things and learned that compromises wait behind each hardly open gate, when I can look life in the eyes, grown calm and very coldly wise, life will have given me the truth and taken in exchange my youth. As I step this year into my 64th year this October, I realize I've exchanged youth for truth. It's a great exchange. It's a wonderful trade-off. Let's pray. We sit quietly in a place like this, and we do our best to allow our minds to pass in review the events of our previous years. Some of us hear words that have been spoken with a sting of fear. What could it be? What may happen? What surprise has the potter planned for this clay? Today, our Father, we trust you. Not only do you have the sovereign right to mold and shape the clay as you wish, you do all things well. You are good. You are full of grace and compassion. And your plan, though painful for us, is fair and best. Thank you that the fire of the trial purifies. And it's designed to deal with our dross and to refine our gold. I ask you to put your arms of love and mercy about our graduating last year students in a very special way during these days that are upon us. While these will be days of celebration and joy and laughter and delight, these are also sobering moments. And it all comes down to that walk across the stage and then the beginning of a whole new world. Soften their hearts and prepare them for your plan that they might cooperate and obey. And teach me, Lord, from the very things I've said, for I'm the slowest of all the learners, it seems. And minister deeply, not only today and these weeks, but in the years ahead, through the things that have been shared from the life of Moses. We ask for Jesus' sake.